This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Today on the show, we bring you the latest from Fiji after the country's police commissioner is asked to step down by the new government. We then return to our usual holiday programming this week, taking a look at the key stories that defined the region this year. Today, we revisit Tonga's devastating volcanic eruption and tsunami that left many people's homes and businesses destroyed.
Everything, like it's a write-off, like it's there's nothing there.
And from the Pacific Islands Forum to trouble with the judiciary in Kiribati to Vanuatu's historic election, we bring you some of the biggest stories of 2022 right here on Pacific Beat.
Being able to carry a female voice into parliament, letting all women in Vanuatu know that there is a female voice sitting up there representing them.
All that and more. I'm Priyanka Srinivasan. So glad to have your company. We interrupt our retrospective holiday episode, as I said, to bring you some latest news from Fiji. Fiji's new Home Affairs Minister has asked the country's police commissioner to resign from his position. Minister Pio Tikonduadua says he lacks confidence in Commissioner Sitiveni Ngilio because of the police head's affiliation with former Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama's government. Let's take a listen to what Fiji's Home Affairs Minister had to say.
With regards to the police commissioner, I met him, okay, and I told him that we have a matter of confidence and trust with him, okay. So I have invited him to resign, but he has asked that we follow the process of the Constitutional Officers Commission, and I agree, and that's what we will do. We have an issue of his affiliation with the Bainimarama government. That is the matter, I'll be honest with you. And that is people's concern. But we respect the law. Okay? We're a new government that has come into power. And I've been frank with him. And I respect his rights under the law. And that's the course that it will take.
As Home Affairs Minister Tikonduadua outlined there, Fiji's police commissioner has declined to step down, asking for the issue to be dealt with through the Constitutional Officers Commission.
Pacific Beat.
You are listening to Pacific Beat on this Friday morning. We have the last of our holiday episodes where we look back at the stories that made the region. We've been covering one country a year, but today we're taking a look at all the major stories out of the year. And let's take you back to almost a year ago when a powerful volcanic eruption in Tonga devastated homes, villages and livelihoods. January's blast sent shockwaves around the world, killing three people and impacting the majority of the country's population. For some local businesses, the financial toll was in the millions, as Marion Farr reported back in January.
On the western coast of Tonga's main island, a resort is in ruins.
It's like a bomb hit this place, you know. It's like a war zone.
The once pristine beach is covered in ash. Trees are strewn across the ground, and the resort's buildings have been flattened.
Everything, like it's a write-off. Like it's there's nothing there.
Marian Tuku'afu is the co-owner of Vakaloa Beach Resort. Up until last week, the business was thriving.
Our venue was one of the biggest here in Tonga.
But now, her livelihood has literally been washed away. A tsunami triggered by the Hungatonga Hungaha'apai volcanic eruption wiped out the popular beachfront resort.
The truth is the damage is just phenomenal. Like, we've never seen anything like that.
Ms. Tuku'afu estimates the cost to rebuild will be about 3 million Tongan pa'anga, which is about 2 million Australian dollars. But it's not just her own family she's worried about. The resort and others in the area provide much-needed employment for locals.
Yeah, it's very sad. And along our coast, all the businesses are wiped out.
More than a week since the eruption, the full economic impact is still unknown. Images on social media show houses covered in ash, businesses damaged and farming land devastated. The World Bank is working with local authorities to assess the financial impact. But Jonathan Pryke from the Lowy Institute says it's clear the cost will be substantial.
By comparison, cyclones in the region have been known to shave off, you know, up to 5% of a country's GDP if they're really badly struck. So, you know, Tonga and other Pacific nations are incredibly exposed to the economic shock of natural disasters. And, you know, this is in a similar sort of category.
And Tonga's economy has already taken a hit with COVID-19.
They've been incredibly successful in keeping COVID out of the country and remaining one of the very few countries in the world that is COVID-free. But that's come at a huge cost to the economy. You know, it's killed tourism overnight and killed many other parts of the economy that are dependent on free movement of people in and out of the country.
Moving forward, Tonga will need help from international partners. The World Bank has provided $8 million in emergency relief, and Australia has committed an initial $1 million with expectations of more funding to come. But Mr. Pryke says another big contributor will be remittances from overseas.
Remittances to Tonga are greater per year than the Australian aid inflows to Tonga. So it's a significant component of foreign exchange, of the economy, and of just people's livelihoods and well-being.
There's already been an outpouring of financial support from Tongans around the world. But while families are eager to send money back home, accessing those funds is a challenge for people on the ground. A large undersea cable providing internet to Tonga was seriously damaged in the disaster, cutting off connectivity. While some services, including banking, are starting to come back online, it's likely to be weeks until the cable is repaired.
I'm sure it has led to a lag of these funds coming to the country.
While some businesses have been completely wiped out, others have jumped into action. Kennedy Penitani owns a bakery in Tonga's capital, Nuku'alofa. On the Sunday after the eruption, he received a call from a government minister asking him to fire up the ovens and provide food for locals.
Sunday morning, I came downstairs and then I start the generator and the boys rock up and then we start baking.
Under Tongan law, shops are usually required to close on Sunday. But Mr. Penitani says this was a special exception.
So to me, I was glad. I was glad that I do my duty to feed the people and help out at this time of hardship.
Since then, the bakery has continued operating. But Mr. Penitani says getting ingredients could be a challenge.
If the shipment doesn't come in, it would be shortage of flour, and also other ingredients for making the bread.
But he's remaining positive about the future. And so is Marian Tuguafu.
I just said, you know, this is not the end of it. I know that there's something better, but we just pray that, you know, sooner or later, you know, we'll see what we're going to be doing. We've still got the heart to go on. like they say, you know, we're Matema Tonga, you know, we die for Tonga. So that's the heart that we have, really.
That was Marian Tuku'afu, ending that report by Marian Farr, which first went to air in January. You could probably tell from those patchy lines and connections into Tonga there. But since then, things have changed. Coming up, we'll be hearing how families in Tonga are finally returning to the islands that they fled following that tsunami and volcanic eruption almost a year ago. And plans are also underway to relocate residents from one of the other worst impacted islands. A project was launched to resettle hundreds whose homes were destroyed, as Adam Jacobson reported back in July.
Out of the ashes of January's eruption, a new village is being built on Tonga's Matatoa. The Paletua project is hoping to rehome the Kanokupolo people, whose village on the main island of Tongatapu was devastated by the tsunamis. But the project's manager, Mosese Vakasiuola, says not everyone is happy with the prospects of moving.
The younger generation accept the fact that they had to move in terms of safety for the future of their children. Older generation still have a strong link to where they grew up, but slowly trying to convince them. They have to do it for their grandchildren and their children.
The $15 million initiative is being led by the Tongan King and Queen and is expected to be completed in around 2 years. Mr. Vakasiuola says this development is a first of its kind for modern Tonga.
Going to have road system, electrical, water supply, and the residential home, together with the town facilities, town hall, and all those bits and pieces. Because this is the first time for Tonga to experience developing a new settlement area from scratch.
This resettlement project is just one part of the nation's recovery effort, which Mr. Vakasiuwala says is coming along slowly.
The overall recovery, it's coming up slowly in terms of food security and the livelihood of people. It's pretty fast. The slow part is the reconstruction of infrastructures. We have identified it is the nature of the beast.
Crystal Ake is a safeguard coordinator for the Mordi Tonga Trust, an NGO which helps vulnerable communities in rural areas. She says the slowdown of the rebuilding effort was due to COVID-19, which caused Tonga to go into lockdown shortly after the eruption.
It halted a lot of the work that we were wanting to do because of the risks involved of having to pass along COVID to each other in the community, and also the community as well. At large, they were very apprehensive. They knew what COVID could do. They've seen it happen in Fiji. And so a lot of them actually requested that we halt a lot of the work that we were supposed to do.
Ms. Ake says resettling other communities displaced by the Hunga Tonga eruption is going to take some time.
So moving forward, we're actually targeting a lot of these communities to get them into food and water security before we move on to resettlement. And just being mindful that resettlement also means that there's a lot of things that go into it. And so it's going to take some time.
But Offa Gutenbar Liki Liki from Tonga's Women's Crisis Centre says rising living costs are adding to the stress from the triple disasters of the eruption, tsunamis and COVID-19.
Our restrictions are loosening up, and we're able now to go out and do shopping and bring in food, and that the prices are just totally ridiculous. It's like 5 pa'anga for 1 or 2 tomatoes. And I'm talking about, you know, the foods that are healthy for us. They're getting more expensive.
Despite these challenges, Ms. Ake is optimistic that Tonga is on the path to recovery and slowly returning to normal.
But I feel as if Tonga is making good progress, and a lot of the work that we're doing and assisting each other, I think we're making the best of what we have at the moment and what we can do. Our spirits are high because we see that the community themselves are always very proactive. And so I think that's one of the best things that we can see, is that people are still in high spirits.
That was Crystal Ake from the Mordi Tonga Trust, ending that report by Adam Jacobson that first went air back in July.
This New Year's Eve, join us to get the party started on the ABC with entertainment for the whole family. Kickstart your night with fun and celebrations from 7:30 PNG time, followed by the early call-in country fireworks. Then watch the best Aussie live music in a concert lineup packed with top artists. And stay up for the spectacular midnight fireworks to see the year out with a bang. Happy New Year! Celebrate your New Year's Eve from 7:30 PNG time on ABC Australia.
Now, it's been a bit of a time since we've heard that theme, because we've put a hold on News Wrap as we go through our holiday episodes here on Pacific Beat, looking back at the key stories that made up 2022. But now I'm joined by reporter Nick Fogarty to take us through some latest news. Good morning, Nick.
Good morning, Priyanka.
Now, just earlier in the show, we covered some of the latest movements being made by Fiji's new government, in particular the request for the police commissioner to step down. But one other significant event happened last night, and that was a speech made by the new Prime Minister, Sitiveni Rambuka. Can you tell us more about that inaugural speech, I should say.
Of course. Sidivini Rambuka, who of course is assuming that prime ministerial mantle for the second time, delivered his inaugural statement to the people of Fiji via the government's social media channels last night. He spoke for about 18 minutes, during which he said that our country is experiencing a great and joyful awakening, that it gladdens his heart to be a part of it, but that he is reminded of the heavy responsibilities he now bears. He also touched on the fact that his cabinet is quite large and its size has drawn a little bit of criticism due to what that size might cost. And he said that it's larger than he had initially planned, with 19 ministers and 10 assistant ministers. But he also said he'd be looking for ways to cut costs elsewhere, beginning with cuts to parliamentarians' paychecks. And he said his government intends to establish specialist reviews in four key areas, being the constitution and legal reform, the economy, defence and national security, and also a forensic examination of the spending of the last Fiji First government. So let's have a listen to some of that speech.
Fear that has haunted Fiji since 2006 is fading away now. Soon it will be gone.
Love will ensure
that it never returns. Ladies and gentlemen, I am honor bound to serve you with every fiber of my being. I entreat you to unite with me and my parliamentary colleagues. We can journey together, free and equal, bound by our deep love for Fiji and our desire for happiness and prosperity.
Very interesting remarks there by Fiji's new Prime Minister, Sidivini Rambuka. And yes, interesting to see him defend those new ministerships, Nick, because I imagine that maybe it was part of those negotiations, those critical negotiations that got the government in power.
Yes.
Meant a bit of a ballooning of the minister posts that were given
exactly,
out.
Exactly, with three parties in the coalition. So.
Exactly, yeah. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see how those ministers, what policies they pass. Now, another sort of story that we've been revisiting today on the show is Tonga and the impacts of that volcanic eruption and tsunami we heard earlier from stories back in January and July about some of the impacts. But now there's been some good news. Some of those most impacted, some of the people who had to be evacuated, in fact, from the islands, have been moved back into new purpose-built housing. Can you tell us more?
Sure. Late last week, 22 displaced families from Atata Island were welcomed into new homes on the main island of Tongatapu, which we heard on Newswrap as well. And that was indeed a grand welcome with various cabinet ministers and diplomatic officials attending. And now a couple of days ago, the families from Mango Island were relocated to Iua Island. Now, Mango Island was totally uninhabitable after the volcanic eruption and the tsunami. So all of the houses there were destroyed. But this relocation now in the last couple of days, it seemed like a joyful occasion there on Iua Island as those families were welcomed to finally make a new start. And there's some great video online of that welcome with all the Iua Island people gathered on the docks there as the boats come in with the families from Mango Island with music and dancing, and it seems like a nice new start for them.
Yes, yes. I wonder how, I guess it's one of those things, obviously they can't return to their homes, and I imagine that they've been there for generations. Mm. But I've seen some of those videos. I think it was Tonga Broadcasting that had some of them out, and a lot of celebrations, and hopefully those residents can move on with their lives after what is, I imagine, being quite a horrific 2022. And there's also been some good news for American Samoa as well. Cruise ships are returning. Is that right, Nick?
Yes. Quite a news wrap this morning about, things returning to normal.
Yes.
With Sidivini Rambuka becoming Prime Minister for the second time and the people returning or being relocated to the islands. And now, new cruise ships coming back to American Samoa. So Radio New Zealand is reporting that those cruise ships will be welcomed back on New Year's Day. Of course, they were paused during the COVID pandemic, as happened to so many Pacific countries. During a meeting of the COVID-19 task force earlier this month, It was revealed that the American Samoan government was preparing a statement to officially announce the reopening. The previous Lolo administration had imposed travel restrictions on the territory, and that continued into the current Lemanu administration, but they began lifting restrictions in the past weeks. So the American Samoa Visitors Bureau Executive Director said that there are 18 cruise ships scheduled to visit there next year.
Wow, more than one a month. That's certainly a return to normal. Maybe that's what the sign is for 2023, things returning back to normal and, returning, well, hopefully to normal for the better. Yes. Thank you, Nick, for those stories.
Thanks, Priyanka.
That was reporter Nick Fogarty bringing us the latest from around the region.
Pacific Beat.
But now, as part of our retrospective show here on ABC Radio Australia's Pacific Beat, I want to take you back to July, when a hiatus because of COVID-19, the Pacific Islands Forum finally met in person in Suva, Fiji. It was a critical meeting of Pacific leaders with climate change action on the agenda, speculation over the diplomatic body's leadership, and of course, the ever-present specter of China's rising influence in the region. In a dramatic blow to regional unity, Kiribati signalled its split from PIF, as Marion Farr reported, as the regional meeting took place in July.
The music may have been cheerful, but heavy topics dominated dialogue on the opening day of the Pacific Islands Forum leaders' meeting in Suva. Australian Foreign Minister Penny Wong addressed the elephant in the room head-on.
Now, as you know, there have been a lot of discussions about Pacific Island Forum unity, and the position the Australian government has consistently taken is we were seeking to support whatever the consensus could deliver, because the most important thing was to ensure that at this time, in a contested world, in a world confronting climate, COVID and the economic recovery from COVID, that the forum remained united.
A Talanoa session focused on development began with a traditional e-Kiribati dance. But the country's delegation was nowhere to be seen. Kiribati's shock decision to ditch the Pacific Islands Forum has left members grappling to restore unity.
The position that the leader of the president of Kiribati has articulated, and I say, along with all other members of the forum, that we seek reconciliation and the door remains open, and we hope that progress can be made there.
And it's not just Pacific governments getting involved. The United States unveiled a suite of measures aimed at deepening its ties with the Pacific. At the top of the list is opening new embassies in Kiribati and Tonga. It will also appoint the first ever US envoy to the Pacific Islands Forum. On top of that, the US will increase its aid footprint in the Pacific and bring back peace corps to the region. Finally, the US, Australia, Japan, New Zealand and the United Kingdom will establish a new regional mechanism to partner with the Pacific. They're calling it Partners in the Blue Pacific. The Vice President's address comes despite the forum's decision not to hold an in-person partners dialogue, which has been a tradition in past years. That meant the US, China and other partner countries were not invited to Suva this week. But Vice President Harris says her virtual appearance came at the invitation of Fijian Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama, who is chairing the forum. And there are other notable absences from the 51st Pacific Islands Forum. Nauru President Lionel Angamea didn't make it, citing COVID-19 concerns, although the country has appointed an envoy to participate in the meeting. And although Marshall Islands was a powerful voice for Pacific unity earlier this year, it turns out it has also left the forum. That's because the Republic took legally binding action to terminate the country's PIF membership after a leadership dispute last year. Efforts to undo the internal legislative action have failed, meaning Marshall Islands President David Kabua also isn't there. But despite the notable absences, the opening day was jam-packed with discussions. Vanuatu Prime Minister Bob Loughman spoke at length about climate action.
Excellencies, I address you in the midst of the crisis, a climate crisis, which does not come from our Blue Pacific region. Having people-centered approaches means talking about our people, our young people of today and young people of tomorrow. The time for slow and steady action has passed.
And Solomon Islands, which has been in the spotlight after signing a controversial security pact with China, says it wants to host the next PIF meeting. An official decision on that is yet to come. Meanwhile, Solomon Islands and Fiji signed a maritime boundary, touting it as a critical step to protecting their country's economic zones.
That was Marianne Farr, who first brought us that report back in July this year as the Pacific Islands Forum was underway. You're listening to a special holiday episode of Pacific Beat, where we look back at the key stories from 2022 across the region. And back in October, Vanuatu elected its first female politician in more than a decade, before Julia King actually made it into office. She said she was feeling quietly confident about the result in this interview that took place in October.
At the moment, my highest hope would be to make it in and to inspire the other women and young aspiring female politicians in Vanuatu that it is possible to make it into parliament. Prior to coming in on this journey, there was not a lot of women in this space that I could reach out to. So just being here for a start, I'm hoping to be able to be able to advise from this vantage point as to how we can work towards getting more women into parliament. That would probably be my highest and one of my first priorities, is to be able to get women motivated and inspired enough to want to make it into parliament in the next elections. As a mother, it takes a lot of me as a person away from my home, which is where my foundation is. So just being able to draw the balance between home, the foundation, the business, and the new hat, being a politician. So being able to carry a female voice into parliament, letting all women in Vanuatu know that there is a female voice sitting up there representing them.
That was a Vanuatu election. Well, she was a candidate at the time. She's since become an MP, Gloria Julia King. She became the first female politician in Vanuatu to be elected into office in more than a decade. And that interview happened back in October. She was speaking with Marianne Farr. That was just an excerpt, though. Listening to Pacific Beat, and as we've been reporting this year, concerns are mounting over the separation of powers in Kiribati. The country's Attorney General was appointed as Acting Chief Justice, and that followed growing tensions between the government and judiciary, with five judges suspended just this year. As Marianne Farr reported back in November, developments this year had lawyers and anti-corruption groups extremely worried.
After months without a functioning judiciary, Kiribati finally has a new top judge. Tesiro Semilota has been appointed as Acting Chief Justice, and she's expected to formally take up the role today. She's the first female and the first citizen of Kiribati to hold the prestigious position. But at least until a few days ago, she was also the Attorney General. That is raising major concerns.
It's obviously a fluid situation, but it's deeply disturbing.
Australian Bar Association President Dr. Matthew Collins KC says the move is completely at odds with judicial independence, which is mandated in Kiribati's constitution.
It undermines the separation of powers, where an Attorney General, who is a member both of the Parliament and of the Executive, is appointed a member of the judiciary.
And he says that's crucial to the wider region.
Look, it's really important for the stability of our region that the small island nations of the Pacific are flourishing democracies.
It's not clear whether Justice Semolotha has officially resigned from her position as Attorney General. The Kiribati government has not responded to the ABC's request for comment. In a social media statement, President Tanesi Maumau said he was proud to appoint Justice Semolotha to the role on Friday, adding that the government would respect the powers of the judiciary. The move comes after the government controversially suspended five senior judges, including Justice David Lambourn, an Australian national. That effectively left Kiribati without a functioning judiciary, something Kiribati Law Society President Birimaka Tekenene believes the government is genuinely trying to address.
It's a starting point, and I think this is a move that the government is now taking to fill in the vacancy within the judiciary.
He's confident Justice Semolotha will be up to the job.
I have no doubt that after taking an oath to office, she will be committed, she will defend the independence of the judiciary and uphold the rule of law.
But many others are not convinced, including Transparency International Australia CEO Clancy Moore.
This latest move is seemingly at odds with the notion of separation of powers and unfortunately weakens democracy and transparency for the people of Kiribati.
He says the new Chief Justice will face a conflict of interest in presiding over a large backlog of criminal cases she approved as Attorney General.
There's real risks, I guess, in the functionings of the court and also how policy is made as well.
Mr. Moore believes it points to a growing trend in some parts of the Pacific.
Increased authoritarianism, attacks on free media and civil society, and a real increase in the risk of corruption, both government and business corruption.
As Kiribati's main development partner, Mr. Moore wants Australia to play an active role in addressing the issues.
And now Marion Farr brought us that report back in November. And as we heard at the time, it is understood that David Lambourn is receiving consular assistance from Australia, which is monitoring the situation. In fact, back in November, a spokesperson from Australia's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade said that Australia has a strong commitment to the rule of law and democratic values, and that it has encouraged the resolution of these issues as part of its ongoing engagement with the government of Kiribati. You're tuned in to Pacific Beat for a very special retrospective episode. We are taking a look back at some of the key stories that made the Pacific in 2022. And you may have heard that Vanuatu has presented its draft resolution seeking an advisory opinion on climate change by the International Court of Justice to the United Nations. A vote on that by the UN members is expected in any week now. If successful, the body would then refer the matter to the ICJ, the world's highest court. But now I want to take you back to September when Vanuatu had started lobbying the UN General Assembly. Speaking to Mackenzie Smith, Vanuatu's special envoy on climate change, Bokoa Kaltonga, said they had endorsements from dozens of countries already.
We could see ourselves struggling with sustaining our level of well-being in the long run. So And these are the sorts of things that we face, challenges that we face, coupled with the fact that our inability to access systems internationally, considering the fact that being small islands, our contribution to climate change and the problem of this is minimal compared to what the industrial nations oppose. So this is the sort of basic concern to a human life.
To get this referred to the International Court of Justice, you're going to need a majority of the 97 member states in the UN General Assembly. How is that going so far?
Well, we are fairly confident we will be able to secure a number of votes. In fact, we've secured endorsements from the CARICOM, the Caribbean community. And most recently, we had the support of the Pacific Island Forum leaders at the Pacific Forum in Suva, Fiji recently. And we've also had confirmation of support from the Organization of the African, Caribbean and Pacific States, which we have been engaging in productive talks with, especially the members of the African group. and also the ASEAN and the EOSIS and the Climate Vulnerable Forum in general. So, and notwithstanding the fact that we've also sought the support of the Australian and the New Zealand government, and we are thankful for their expressions of their support towards this ICJ Advisory Opinion Initiative.
That was Vanuatu's Special Envoy on Climate Change, Bakug Haltonga, speaking there back in September to Mackenzie Smith. Of course, we are still waiting for that critical vote on that resolution to get climate change to the ICJ. Now you're joining us on Pacific Beat for a special retrospective look at the key stories that made up 2022. And we're also wrapping up the top sports stories of our featured nation every day this week. Now, so far this week, we've covered Fiji, Solomon Islands and Papua New Guinea. But unfortunately, as today is Friday, we need to bring you the best of the rest across Tonga, Samoa, Vanuatu and beyond. Pacific nations certainly shone on the world stage in 2022, as Nick Fogarty reports.
In November, Samoa took the world by storm.
Crichton's got time to try and win it for Samoa, and Stephen Crichton is a history maker! Samoa into the final of the Rugby League World Cup! What a moment for rugby! What a moment for that nation!
Their journey to become only the fifth nation to make the final in almost 60 years of Rugby League World Cups was a thrilling one, knocking off England 27-26 in a nail-biting semi-final. It wasn't to be in the decider against Australia with a scoreline of 30-10, but history had already been made, and it was all the more sweet having lost their opening match to England 60-6. Tor Samoa captain Junior Paolo had this to say to his players after the semi-final win.
Never forget the impact that we've had on the world. Don't forget the impact that we've had on those people around the world who have never met us but have always supported us right from the get-go.
The team's success drew Samoans out to party on streets across the region, including in Melbourne, where community leader Tony Fretton said he'd never seen so much excitement.
When we talk about it's for now, right now, now that we're in the final, it's almost like a Pacific. It's all the Pacific community in Melbourne and Victoria, not just the Samoan ones.
Along the way, Samoa met Tonga, narrowly beating them in the quarterfinal, while Cook Islands were also good enough to knock over Wales in their group game. Cook Islands also had success in the women's tournament, beating France. Heading into 2023, the Samoan men also sit on top of the World Rugby Sevens table, having just won their first tournament since 2016. And at the Commonwealth Games, the Samoans collected 3 silver and a gold in weightlifting and a silver in boxing. To Vanuatu now, whose athletes also tasted success at the Commonwealth Games. Mila Pata and Sherison Toko won bronze in the beach volleyball, a sport that continues to be an area of major focus in the country. Bella Lawak is one of Vanuatu's next generation of beach volleyball stars, and in December she spoke about her hopes for the future.
I'm very honoured to represent my country, and also, yeah, like beach volleyball can take me like visit all the place around the world. Yeah, like go and participate.
The Vanuatu women's cricket team also finally returned to the field after they and their opponents had been starved of action during the pandemic. Samoa, Fiji and PNG travelled to Port Vila for the inaugural Women's T20 Pacific Cup, with PNG narrowly edging out Vanuatu on the table. The national men's team were also in action in Malaysia, but their performances resulted in relegation from World Cup Challenge League A. On the soccer pitch, it was a year to remember for perhaps the biggest name in Vanuatu sport, Brian Keltak, who signed his first professional contract. It was with A-League club Central Coast Mariners, and the 28-year-old central defender duly debuted in October. He told Pacific Beat it was a long time coming.
It's been a long journey, playing in the islands and then moved to New Zealand. And then my aim was to get a professional contract one day, and I was just praying for it. And I knew that I would get it. I just have to keep pushing myself.
And lastly, to the Tongan women's netball team, which rocketed to 8th in the world after being unranked at the start of 2022. The team was undefeated this year, will play in its first Netball World Cup next year, and were welcomed and given the name Tala by the Queen, following victories at two Pacific Oz tournaments and the Oceania Championships. Vice Captain Claire Longhi was bullish about the future of the game in Tonga.
I feel like it will have a massive impact, especially now that netball is making a name for itself. Usually league or union have bigger impact in Tonga. So I feel like our success comes from our people, and I think our people know that. So I feel like they'll just feed off that, and hopefully the game grows here as well.
And that's the year in sport for the Pacific.
That was reporter Nick Fogarty bringing us that special wrap of sport around the region for 2022. And that just about brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. I want to thank everyone who made all the stories this year possible, from Evan, Richard, Kyle, Chris and Rita, Jordan, Marion, Dubrovka, Lide, Adam, Faith, Nick, Marion, Mackenzie, Annika, Mel, Edwina, Hugo, Jan, Adam, Talia, and of course all the people behind the scenes who bring the show onto air, Jules, Chrissy, Marcus, who's behind the panel right now, AJ, Elise, Emma, I'm sure I've forgotten many, many people. But thank you all for making Pacific Beat what it is, and thank you to our dear listeners, all of you tuned in today especially. I hope you all enjoy a lovely New Year's. Can't wait to do it with you all again in 2023.